Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome to Nightlight, everybody. So glad you could join me today. It's going to be an exciting interview. I have with me today Richard Grossinger, and his book is called Becoming, Bottoming Out the Universe, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. And it's an amazing book. You're going to be fascinated with it, as am I. Let me tell you a bit about it. In this investigation into consciousness, the universe, and the nature of reality, Richard Grossinger offers a wide-ranging foundation for reimagining the universe as based in consciousness rather than matter. He presents in-depth analysis of the standard scientific description of the universe, revealing the holes in its theories, exploring the interpenetration of matter and all reality by consciousness. He looks at reincarnation and past life memories, examining famous and lesser known but verifiable accounts. He then explores the nature and origin of consciousness with accompanying explorations of animal consciousness, the brain as a computer, multiple identities, thought forms, soul pictures, and paranormal phenomena like UFOs, fairies, and poltergeists. He also examines concepts from physics that combine elements of both consciousness and matter, such as collapsing waveforms and the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics. Examining non-logical and transpersonal modes of consciousness, he looks at the difference between consciousness and personal identity. He expands this discussion with reflections on Sethian cosmology using Seth's own words and Jane Roberts and John Friedlander's interpretations. He reveals that consciousness also encompasses what is yet to manifest and explains why the universe exists at all, why there's something rather than nothing. Skewering the materialist paradigm and placing consciousness alongside mass, gravity, and heat as an essential component of the universe, he proposes that reality is a thought form where sentient beings collaborate to bring about concrete realm vibrating at their own frequency. This book was written a bit ago, and since then he has evolved, as has his philosophy, so it's going to be fascinating to see just how far further ahead he has taken all of these concepts, because of course if we don't continue to grow, there's no point in being here. So just a bit about him. He's the founding publisher of North Atlantic Books. He has a PhD in anthropology from University of Michigan, and he's the author of several books. So I want you to take a look at his material, because if you are a seeker, if you are looking to understand not only our reality, but we're your place in it and your place as a consciousness rather than just a physical species. This is a great book to take up and take a look at and tweak your own identity, so to speak. Welcome to the show, Richard. I'm so glad we finally made this happen.
Yeah, thank you, Barbara. Let me sort of reflect on your presentation of me. I as I listened, a few things crossed my mind that maybe needed nuancing. One is, I felt badly for you because you were kind of stuck with the promotional material. and I know from having talked to you that that your own words are much fresher. And when people sit down and write promotional material, they kind of condense it all into, you know, a thing that goes by much too quickly with much too much detail. So I kind of felt I pretended to be an audience member hearing it and realized that both you and they were kind of the victims of like a very condensed version that tried to fit in everything. And the other thing I'll mention is that I'm presently the acquiring editor for Sacred Planet Books, which is part of Inner Traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And this book actually, this book, Bottoming Out the Universe, marks my bridge to Inner Traditions. Because at the time that I began to write it, I was not affiliated with Inner Traditions. And I connected with them. I had connected with them on and off over the years because we were both spiritual publishers. When I connected with them in 2018, I had already begun writing this book, and Ehud Sperling, the publisher of Inner Traditions, wanted to see what I was writing and ultimately accepted it for his list. And the book itself is somewhat of a collaboration between me and them. But at the same time, my own press, which my wife and I had begun as a literary magazine all the way back when we were in college, like more than 50 years prior, had been, I don't know the right word, it had been taken over by the enemy, basically. It had been in the kind of culture wars that are going on now, and in my own kind of aging and leaving the active role of publishing, it was taken over by people who basically disagreed with most of my fundamental spiritual premises. And so I want to be clear, I have no connection with that press, with North Atlantic Books, since 2018. And so what it presently is doesn't reflect me. But what does reflect me is the Sacred Planet list at Inner Traditions. And there I've kind of continued my role as a publisher.
Well,
I'll pass it back to you.
I think that coming from a metaphysical background myself, over the last 50 years, you know, I always find that there are parts of all of the books that I read, that I do, you know, interviews for. I always look for those elements within the material that you know, sort of tingle me and make me think and make me want to go deeper and deeper and deeper. And certainly you use the Seth material, which I am familiar with, and the Hellinger material, which I'm sort of familiar with. And you go into some of the elements of consciousness that I have been not struggling with, but sort of, it's like a great big jigsaw puzzle, and I keep finding a piece here and there that just fits into my own philosophy at this level of consciousness that I am right now, and the element of consciousness, of course, during these times when there is, as somebody so succinctly put it, there certainly is a disturbance in the force. We are all experiencing all sorts of reactions to unsettlement, either cosmically or scientifically with sunspots, or just our own development and asking questions about our purpose and our, you know, why are we here and who are we and all of that kind of thing. And so your book had elements of insight into all of these different areas, which, you know, got me to thinking. And quite frequently, to be honest with you, I would read a portion of your book and have to put it down and really think about everything that I have learned and that I have pulled together and how it fits so beautifully into some of that material. So that it's why I am so very excited about the book. Some of the scientific stuff it was interesting, but when it came to the consciousness material, that's where I just ate it up like candy. And I think that you're looking into what is consciousness and how does it differ from our identity, and, you know, how does it travel through time and dimension and space, and all of that is so fascinating to me. I couldn't wait to talk to you.
When I knew that this interview was scheduled, and as you kind of alluded to, we've been trying to set this up for quite a while and run into various technical difficulties, I felt removed enough from my writing of the book that I spent a few hours with it yesterday rereading large chunks so that I could familiarize myself with what I said. And that put me in the position of being like one of the readers. I mean, some things surprised me because I hadn't thought about them since, and I'd forgotten they were in the book. And other things I recognized as having been woven into my thinking and evolved since then. But the main thing I came away with, which kind of replicates what you're saying, is that the vision in the book is packed with every element that could shed light on this topic, from the most scientific to the most metaphysical. And I finally decided, and this has been true of all my work, that it functions energetically apart from the way it functions literally. So that there is a text and it does say things, and when I read it now, I think, oh, some of this is a little bit overly literary, and I'm being a little bit too kind of lyrical. But it doesn't matter because it's already in print. But
yeah.
Also, it doesn't matter because energetically, something is being created. I'm not the sort of writer who has a topic and then sits down and fills it in. I'm more the sort of writer who creates the topic as I go along. And I know what my territory is, what I'm going to write about, but I don't have a map that I fill in. I let, whether you call it the muse or the spirit guide, or the vibration, fill itself in. And so it brings things together in ways that are of the moment and have the energy of the moment. And that's why, for, you know, quantum physics can come together with the Seth material or with the thinking of Adi Da, or with notions of animal consciousness, and as you mentioned, the family constellations, Hellinger work, And like your jigsaw puzzle metaphor, the jigsaw puzzle arranges itself in a particular way, and that's like anything else. It's fluctuating and changing from its own energy field. So I consider the book Bottoming Out the Universe an energy field created between 2015 and 2019, when I was also working on other books that were more autobiographical, more like nonfiction novels. And when I try and think of how I would summarize it now, I look at the sort of what I come down to at the end, which is that all of the arguments, either for a mechanical universe in which consciousness is simply a chemical reaction, a hallucination, and a universe in which consciousness is the driver behind everything, in not only matter but all the forms matter takes. I think that I struggle finally to an image that the universe looks the way it's supposed to look if it were either matter or consciousness, because the two converge. Spirit descends into a physical universe which is arising to meet it. But that physical universe has been brought into being by the kind of collaboration of spirit across its many different vibrations or frequencies and creature forms that it takes. And those shapes, those creature forms and dimensions, are brought into being by matter as it evolves in its own context. And within that kind of broader basket, I bring in ranges of thought from Buddhists to I give some space to Terence Deacon's teleodynamic universe, which is a completely scientific one, and look for correspondences. And then, as I said, the book gives the reader, like you, an energy field. And because you're already meditating within the same general energy field, you get a kind of inspiration or a boost. But I think the inspiration is your own, and we share it. But that's what the writing is.
Oh, yeah. Well, I found it fascinating how you had it set up, whether intentional or not. You would go for one section into very scientific stuff, and then the next section had to do with more of the spiritual, the consciousness type of material, which, of course, I ate up. And there was I stopped myself because I had to read it all the way through, because I always read the book before I do an interview, and I read the whole book. And, you know, there it was almost like I can hopscotch through this and just, you know, be almost giddy from the material. And then it was, nah, come on, the scientific stuff. There's something here to learn. There's something here to understand. And there's some words to learn how to pronounce. So that it gave me the intellectual stimulation of the scientific stuff, and then the emotional, spiritual joy of the consciousness material and the past life material. And you know, it was a fun read. It really was. And if I was going to go back and reread it, I'd hopscotch. But the element of the consciousness and you know, where does it come from? It's sort of like, you know, what is the meaning of spirit, and what is spirit? And So let's look at consciousness and how would you define it? Because it's etheric. It's nothing. You can't put a finger on it. You can't draw a picture of it. You can't label it. This is consciousness. This is not. I mean, if you're talking material, then you can say, okay, that's scientific and that's consciousness. But didn't consciousness actually create science?
Well, these are words, and so when we play with words, we get a little bit caught up in the meanings that we then kind of articulate when we use the words. I dealt with that, you know, I originally had it around more in the book, but the editor at Inner Traditions put it first, which was addressing the fact that the scientists who explored consciousness came to two very different conclusions. One group of scientists, who I quote, came to the conclusion that even though we couldn't say yet how consciousness fit into matter, that we would eventually be able to do so, that it was not an ultimate problem, that there would be an explanation for consciousness arising purely from matter. And the other group of scientists, including many prominent ones, concluded that there could never be an explanation for consciousness within a material description of the universe. And although they didn't say it, I would say that that's because consciousness is the source of matter. And some of them, I don't remember exactly which ones, I still think it's the way memory works, that you quote people who are really exciting to you at a given moment, and then the moment passes and you actually forget who said it. You more absorb it into your own being, and it becomes part of you. And you can, I mean, some people with kind of eidetic memory can tell you all of this, but I can't. But I do think that that where I end up is pointing out that when you can't fit consciousness into matter, you can't arrive at it through a description of matter, you end up automatically with the reverse, that matter is the secondary form, is the form of consciousness, not personal consciousness, not our individual consciousness, that consciousness is an overriding energy, that is what's created the material universe that we then live in as individual consciousnesses, which in the book I call personal identity. And mm-hmm. I make a distinction between personal identity and consciousness. Some people, I know Jeff Kripal is one, refer to the brain as a receiving mechanism for consciousness. That is, consciousness exists at large, or in one of the models I use, and I continue to use this personally, it comes from the etheric most immediately. We pass through an etheric self and then manifest in a physical form. And the etheric universe, which is pretty much invisible and impalpable to us, is just as real as the physical universe. But we're no longer there. We are asked to live now in a physical universe and to work with its obstacles and difficulties. And in the second chapter, I which was when I first wrote it, the first chapter, I go through the many accounts of past life memories where people remember a past life as a different person. And I use the work of Ian Stevenson and his associates who went and researched and tracked down the individuals who these people had been. And this is only in instances where the past life was within the lifetime, where the new life was in the lifetime of the past person. Otherwise, it couldn't be tracked down. But I have those too, starting with the famous case of Bridie Murphy, whose past life was centuries earlier in Ireland. There was no way to track that down or research it. And since I mentioned the etheric, I'm kind of reconstructing my own book in a different way now. Stevenson was particularly taken with the fact that when people died from a particular disease or an injury or were shot with a gun or killed with a knife or sword, a lot of these happened in India and Burma and Pakistan and stuff, where within our lifetime such things were still happening. The particular means of death showed up as a birthmark or a scar on the new person. If the past person had had a tumor somewhere that had been fatal, the new person had a birthmark there. Or in some cases had a deformity where there had been a very severe wound. And that would seem to me to indicate that the etheric realm is a place where DNA resides as well, only it's etheric DNA. And it passes through the etheric into the physical. That would be the only way to explain how physical events as well as conscious events, mental events, emotional events can pass between lifetimes. So I use that, I think a few chapters later, I go into the seven planes of consciousness, starting with the physical etheric and going up through the astral and the mental causal and the Buddhic and Atmic and so forth, and try to show that each of them is their own domain. And each of them has consciousness and reality at its own frequency. And I make the argument that these flow down through the planes into the physical plane and take a shape there resembling their shape on other planes. And it's another way of saying that that conscious forms become physical forms. I mean, similarly, the Big Bang version of the universe, the notion that the universe arose from like the single tiny point that exploded, which is a fantastic, incomprehensible idea, that something so small that it could fit many times on a pinhead has exploded or imploded into this vast array of stars and worlds. Again, the physical reality is better understood as the manifestation of a metaphysical or spiritual reality.
In some ways, though, aren't we the theory of as above, so below, aren't we a universe unto ourselves? In that, you know, our physicality is the Big Bang, and that as you go out in the different layers of consciousness or awareness or spirit, the further out you go, the closer you get to the source.
Yeah, I mean, I probably hear this in my own way, but that's how these kind of interviews work. It's a little bit like hitting a tennis ball back and forth and trying to keep its shape.
Yeah.
I discovered, we had a brief discussion before the interview. We were both born in 1944, Barbara and I. And I think that as you get older and there's less space between you and your transformation, either into something or nothing, and I give the nothing people a good amount of space in my book. But I think it becomes a more serious and personal question. And probably the main thing that I would add to the book, to Bottoming Out the Universe, in the 4 years since I finished it and it got published, is that my own belief system is more on the line because it's put on the line by my having a body and having to follow the body at this point. I can't just say I'm spirit, I'm going to leave the body at this point, or I'm going to go on. No, the body is the continuity that leads to the next thing. And if there is no next thing, then we disappear. I quote one novelist who has his character child say to his father, "What happens when you die?" And the father says, "Nothing happens. Nothing happens forever." Well, that's a large portion of the world believes that or doesn't think about it. Sometimes I ask people, what do you think is going to happen after you die? And they, the most recent person said, I prefer to be in denial about it. But that speaks for a lot of the civilization. And as the civilization becomes more and more materialized and artificial intelligence, which I kind of foreshadow by writing about in the book, even though it didn't have its present form when I wrote it, is sort of the epitome of converting personal identity into a machine and kind of reducing us to a mechanistic level. I want to follow this thread, and then there's half of that sentence or concept is missing. But I did want to say in the book, I actually talk about, I was surprised to see this, that I talk about Elon Musk and his desire to live, if not forever, a much longer time by transferring himself into a consciousness singularity and then recreating himself later. And also, he and others believe, apparently, or at least say they believe, that this whole reality is a computer simulation anyway, and that we're simply characters in a computer game being played by beings at another part of the universe. Well, all of this is dizzying, and in the book, I address it all because I'm covering the range of belief systems. Now, to go back to the other half of what I was saying, as we, each of us, and that includes eventually Elon Musk and all the other characters in the present play of the world, the outer reality is not only becoming more mechanistic, it's becoming more discordant, like you said earlier. It's like there's a, I think you said, a distortion in the
force
field.
Yeah.
What? In the force.
The distortion, yeah.
In the store. My favorite astrologer, I don't know if you know Elias Lonsdale, but he's somebody, I've known him since the 1970s, more as a friend and as an author. I've published at both presses. But I talk to him every few weeks. He's an eternal optimist because he believes in consciousness. But he did open our last conversation by saying, it's getting ugly out there. And how that struck me even yesterday when I saw online the new thing of people walking down the street and randomly punching other people in the face, which you might have read about, that this is a new recreation. And I don't want to get into why they're doing that. And then I read yesterday of somebody interrupting thieves stealing his catalytic converter off his car and being shot and killed. When Elias said things are getting ugly out there, I think of that, and certainly of the wars and the way the wars are being conducted, and then the kind of wars within those wars for what is the appropriate way to conduct a war, or what side are you on, or whose position do you take, which then leads to other wars. I posted on Substack a kind of running set of notes I called The Return of the Tower of Babel, because it feels like a sort of Babel at this point, that everybody is caught in crosswinds of belief and confusion. As I say that, I'm reminded of the Bob Dylan line, "There's a lot of confusion around here," said the Joker to the thief.
Yeah.
There's a tremendous amount of confusion. So you and I, and numerous other people, and ultimately everybody, confronts their own mortality at the same time as they confront the disruption in the field. And the two come together to make a kind of riddle, a sort of Zen koan, as to what is the purpose of being here? I quote Jacob Needleman in Bottoming Out, the philosopher, as saying, I look about and see a universe of death, yet I look within and see a universe of life and consciousness. And that's sort of our plight. And in Bottoming Out the Universe, I suggest that's meant to be our plight, that we are meant to come up against a kind of existential doubt in order to move consciousness forward, and that that consciousness only becomes more conscious by confronting its own inherent obstacles, by confronting those disruptions in the force. Subsequent to that book, I wrote another book that Inner Traditions published called Dream Times and Thought Forms that you and I are going to talk about in a week or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then more recently, they worked with me on rewriting my homeopathy book, which I originally wrote as chapters in a book called Planet Medicine back in the 1970s, and then turned into its own book. And at the time that that my wife's and my own press was taken over and vandalized, among the things that happened was all of my books got put out of print, all of my earlier books. And there, that includes Planet Medicine and The Night Sky. And the book that immediately precedes Bottoming Out the Universe, book called Dark Pool of Light, Reality and Consciousness, that was in separate volumes, one dealing with the science of consciousness and one dealing with psychic and psycho-spiritual consciousness, and the third dealing with the crisis and future of consciousness, which is what Bottoming Out the Universe picks up. But one of the books was the homeopathy book, and I just recently finished rewriting it with them and with Inner Traditions, and it's coming out in July. And it continues to extend this discussion because you can't escape it. Healing medicine lies at the core of the crisis, and consciousness is itself a way of healing the lesions in, I won't say the universe, but in what Seth calls all that is. We exist to try and heal that. And when I was talking to you earlier, before the show, you had mentioned, I'm going to tiptoe here, that that these days, even to talk about medicine and healing, is to run into the Tower of Babel, because there are so many conflicting views, and people who will agree with you on one thing entirely then will disagree with you on another. I find that it's just kind of maddening to not know anymore who's on your side and who's against you, and you do tiptoe, and you've said that we want to keep the broadest possible audience for this show because consciousness is operating at a higher frequency than these distortions. But then these distortions are themselves feeding consciousness. And before I get any more kind of snarled in this, I'm going to let you have your turn at the volleying.
Well, I think that one of the things that you've mentioned that is definitely happening is there was a roving reporter for one of the TV stations, and I can't remember which it was, but they were asking people about where do you go when you die? And I would say 90% of the people said, that's it, nothing, darkness. And I was shocked.
Yeah, nothing forever.
Yeah, and that to me blew me away because, you know.
Well, that's in the Western world.
Well,
and
yeah.
And then people in the non-Western world, some of them believe in, you know, punishment or reward. And that really, that's really just in its own way as dualistic as nothing. It doesn't respect consciousness at all. It simply sets up a court of. It's almost like reality is a computer simulation. Then you end up having to face the programmer.
Well, you know, you're talking Matrix type stuff too,
mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
And what I'm finding here in, I have grandchildren who are just now going off to college or just graduating, and I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, okay, you have a spiritual foundation. You know, your parents were, you did good. They've got a spiritual foundation. And yet they are constantly looking at a cell phone or a laptop or whatever, and they're not dipping into opening those portals within them that brings consciousness and awareness and wisdom into their reality. And it breaks my heart, because these spirits, these souls that they've got, you know, has a richness within them that just needs to be unlocked to make their life so magical. And I
asked a Tibetan Lama who came through Maine last fall. I remembered that he had daughters, and I asked him if they were a follow. I mean, he is a teacher of Dzogchen. I asked if they were interested in it. He said, no, they're on TikTok. They want to manifest.
And I think that's one of the purposes of this show, hopefully, that if somebody listens to you and I talking about this stuff, they will open to the potential or to the possibility of the potential that they carry within.
It's already there.
Well, that's what's so magical. You know, you were talking about writing and not really knowing where it was going to take you, and that's exactly what I do when I do, I call it channeling, but it's the same thing. I stop thinking with my brain and allow my spirit to flow. I think most people don't make that decision. They don't understand that they think, and this is my opinion, and I should you know, say it right out front. When I talk to authors like you and stuff like that, I give my philosophy. It doesn't mean it's right. It just means that at this moment in time, it's right for me. But I truly believe that the brain is like a computer, a storehouse. It's a filing house. We learn something, we store it away, and it brings it back in, you know, when it's appropriate. But at the same time, our consciousness is timeless, and in my opinion, has evolved throughout time and has magic and philosophy and wisdom that comes from the ages that can help to enrich and expand whatever wisdom I've got within me, so that I'm a better source of information from time to time. And that's the point of my website. That's the point of these shows. It's my way of getting voices out there that have information that go beyond the thinking brain into the seeking spirit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and just to briefly glance over it, that's what the press that my wife and I originally started as teenagers was about, and it evolved as we evolved. But when we hit a more political era, it was taken over by people who then politicized it and continued the shell but lost the essence, the energy. That doesn't mean that energy was in every single book, but it framed the context from which the books came. And I don't know, I don't follow what they're publishing since. It's a discipline that I maintain. I think when it was taken over, it was taken over from the standpoint that we published from white privilege, and that had to be changed in order to reflect the true nature of our times. So that's a little that's a response to what you were saying about your show and the work. But my own response to the other part of what you're saying, the interviews, 90% of the people, is that I've tried to think about what do people think? My wife just did a Saturday at the Elder Salon of the local Unitarian Church, and for a while she was thinking of asking them what did they think happened to them after they died, and then she decided it was probably the Unitarian Church was exactly not the place to do that. So she changed it to what gives you joy. But I told her that I don't think any of us know what happens to us. So that it could be nothing, where it could be what 90% of the people think. I don't think it's a judgment. My author, Matt McKay, my author at Sacred Planet, he channeled his son who was murdered. He channeled him in a book called Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife that I actually do also quote from in Bottoming Out the Universe as saying that there isn't a heaven and hell or a judgment. But we don't know that. That's one of the options. What I think, and I don't really deal directly with this in the book, in the chapter comparing Seth and Buddhism, but I think is implicit there, is that I don't know whether, as in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, we confront our soul and it overwhelms us with like thunder and lightning and demons with brightness greater than 10,000 suns and all the demons that are locked in our personality, which is kind of an unsettling idea and probably why many people would prefer nothing to that, or whether, as in so many of the more Sethian guided versions, we're met by our ancestors, the souls of those who died before us, we're given a chance to review our recent past life and our recent life, and to learn from it, and then eventually go back into amnesia and return in some other form to evolve further, which would mean that that's already happened and that's what we're doing now. We are the future life of our past lives, even as they're the past life of us. It's very confusing because it involves a transposition between a place where time exists here and a place where time doesn't exist, the realm of the soul or the spirit, and the transit back and forth between them. I deal with that in the chapter on Dolores Cannon, and I forget what you call it, what she calls it. I didn't know this when I wrote the chapter. It's something like QHHT or something, or the name of her system. But it involves locating not just individual past lives, but strings of past lives that go back through history. And in my book, I just deal with this one woman in Texas who discovered a past life in Hiroshima at the time of the attack. And so I forget whether he was killed in it or just saw it, but it was devastating to him. And when the memory got triggered in her, she re-experienced it and then re-experienced past lives.
Yeah,
I'm doing a terrible job of that.
No, that was to me a fascinating section because I've done a lot of work with the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs and stuff like that. And so she was taken through hypnosis back to the time of the bomb. And then he did the male energy. He did survive the bomb. And but talked about how his hands turned black and you know it was beautifully done. Charlie Pellegrino wrote a book called The Last Train from Hiroshima, and he interviewed a ton of people that had actually survived not only Hiroshima but Nagasaki, and it's a book everybody should read because it talks about the explosion and what happened. Particular one, he did survive and he did eventually die, but he was sick and he, you know, it was a very unhappy time. And the person who was taking him through the hypnotic experience then had him go back to a happier time. And it was surprising at how, you know, that there was sadness and there was grief and there was anguish. And then, you know, she said to go back to an earlier time when he talked about a celebration and everybody was happy and everybody was joyful. So that was really a fascinating experience. And,
right,
you know,
all these versions of oneself exist simultaneously.
Yeah. And to be able to do that, but you know, that's all through hypnosis. And, you know, you do wonder, In dream state and stuff like that, we do get glimpses of past lives, I believe, and it's really quite fascinating from time to time. And there was somebody, one of the people that you talked about who had experienced past lives, and somebody, I can't remember who it was, but at one point he said he took a couple hundred years off being a tree, and which I found fascinating because, you know, to go from being a person to a tree to an animal to whatever, that fascinated me. I'd not really heard of that before. But you were talking about how everything, even rocks, have consciousness, and though it is not the same consciousness a worm has, or
right, that if anything is conscious, then everything is conscious because the molecules can become conscious.
They're aware, and you know, I guess in many ways, consciousness is awareness as well. So that, and if you have consciousness, then you have the ability to manifest, and that fascinated me too. I got a better grasp of consciousness from reading your book because of all the different approaches.
Yeah, me too, from reading it. Yes. There are all these different versions. This is the first interview I've done in a while. I have a bunch of podcasts coming up on this new book, which is called Homeopathy is Energy Medicine. And so this one, I can't even remember the last one I did, but it's got to be more than a year ago. And I realize in doing it, there's the book that at the time you write it, and you get to edit it and change it and sort of get it in the best form you can. And then you immediately begin changing and forgetting. Mm-hmm. And so by the time you interview me, I'm not the best person on my own book, even. And if enough time passes, I remember William Faulkner was interviewed on some of his earlier novels, and he couldn't remember them.
Well, yeah.
And he's the one who wrote them. But then, even in the interview, I see how it works again. It's a little bit like paint. Once you splatter it, you can't take it back. So I find myself with one part of my mind tracking where I am and seeing where I've spilled paint and can't take it back. And then with another part of my mind, I'm kind of noting various openings that you leave for me to talk about stuff that's in the book or stuff in my present thinking, and I'm weighing which of them is the best one to go to next. So it's a very fluid form, and I hope that listeners understand that the what makes it, at least this kind of interview, interesting is the dynamic quality of it, that it's just that we're two mortals at a particular moment dealing with stuff that is much larger than ourselves and is fundamentally not comprehensible in a literal sense. I know that there are people who do better interviews than me in the sense of they really have their material together, and it's like they pull the file cards out and they know exactly what they want to say. But it's not that kind of book, and I don't generally do that kind of interview. And I guess you do so many interviews that you've developed your own style. And
well,
format.
My theory is that anybody who's written a book that has been published by some place like Inner Traditions or Llewellyn or whatever, they have press releases, they have the talking points that they hand out. I mean, I've got pages of talking points here on this book, but my philosophy is, you know, if the interviewer has read the material, then that gives you both a platform to learn and to grow and to expand on. So for me, talking points are nice to have, but the reality is the interview itself has to take on a life of its own to be vital and vibrant so that people listening can feel that there is a flow of energy going on. And you know, whether or not they want to read the book is a whole other ball of wax, but something you or I have said is going to trigger something within every person that listens to this, and they're going to expand upon it in their own way. And, you know, rather than give you, you know, lead you into the 10 points of the talking points and questions, I think those are for people that aren't going to read the book, so that they need to have some way to give you a lead in to talk about what you've written. But I would think that an author, I've written a couple books too, and I have found that when I have given talking points, whoever is interviewing me is going question to question to question to question, and the answers are so dry. I mean, it's after you've said them 30 or 40 or 50 times, it's like, oh my God, this is so boring. It's boring for me. It has to be boring for whoever's listening. So that's why I would rather see a conversation take on a life of its own, because then there's vibrancy. Then there's everybody's growing a little bit and learning something.
Mm-hmm. Well, out of the blue, what I'll throw in is that I did a book with Inner Traditions pretty recently, within the last year, by an author named David Barreto, a young Brazilian living in England. And it's on animal karma and reincarnation. And it discusses the different pathways by which different animals, plants, and minerals reincarnate, the different cycles, and what each cycle gives them. And he discusses ants as well as cats and dogs, and he discusses flowers and periods of life, periods of existence as different stones. And whether you believe it or not, it's he makes it very credible. At least he makes a credible story, that it doesn't just seem like he's pulling it out of the blue. And likewise, I looked at your website and saw that part of it was psychic reading of the future. You were looking at the world. I don't know when you actually did the psychic reading, but you were looking at the future that you could see the picture of.
Mm-hmm.
What do I want to make? I don't that I want to make anything of that. I talk one of my authors, Laura Aversano, with Inner Traditions, one of the first authors I did there, is a medical intuitive, but also a general psychic. And she scans the world, or the world comes to her, and sort of discloses energies that are still forming.
Mm-hmm.
And I see you as doing a version of that. I think I only do that in the writing. I've tried to imagine if I do any straightforward divination. And I'm not good at what you or Elias or Laura do, which is becoming totally neutral so that these events flow in towards you.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was kind of laughing, thinking I go to the skating rink for exercise, and while I was skating a few weeks ago, I thought, I remember when I used to try and see auras, and I tried to see auras of other skaters, and I immediately fell down. And I almost never fall down while skating. That's part of it. If I did, I wouldn't go. But and that reminded me that you can try and see auras. Maybe you don't have that frequency. Maybe you feel them, or maybe you intuit them in a way that has nothing to do with the senses, and
mm-hmm.
it comes from the way you read people when you see them. You see them and you know something about them that they didn't tell you. And sometimes I try that out. That seems more realistic. I often know things that people don't think of, but then I'm also terribly wrong some of the time. And is that because I do a bad job, or because I don't actually want to know what I'm reading in the people?
Part of it probably is that if you're thinking, you're involving your mind, and you're not opening yourself up to what spirit can give you. You're analyzing. And, you know, with auras especially, you don't have to see the color, you just know it's there. And if you just know it, then you've gotten that on a spiritual level. I know that in this field, when I was beginning, every now and then it was like meditation. You know, you knew what you were supposed to do, and if you were sitting there and you were just getting that feeling of lifting and everything, the thought occurs, oh, this must be meditation. Well, if you're thinking, it's not. So that mm-hmm. so that with the creative process especially, thinking is a terrible thing because it gets in your way. The ego gets there. And when the ego is in charge, the ego only has this lifetime to draw from as far as a frame of reference goes, so that whatever you do is going to be very constricted. And yet if you send the ego out to the movies and hopefully a double feature, then spirit can just flow through you and give you all sorts of magical stuff. I every now and then I discover something on the computer that I either gathered or wrote or whatever, and I will, sometimes I'll find something that is just so brilliant I can't imagine where it came from, but I want to use it, and I send it through one of those you know, those sites that, you know. Yeah, well, I send it through one of these things to see if someone else wrote it.
Oh.
And if nobody else wrote it, then I must have written it. And mm-hmm. sometimes it's like, well, this is too good. I couldn't possibly have written this. But the reality is, if I wasn't thinking and I was allowing some level of me to flow through or to open the door to something else that's out there that's just floating around waiting to be manifested, it's a really cool thing. But especially with things like auras and meditation and, you know, all of the other little kinds of psychic, you know, tricks or gifts that we try to use. If you're thinking, you've got your mind going. If you've got your mind going, you're linked into the physical and your feet are firmly planted, and that's it. And just don't think and allow. And then magic does happen. And well, I learned that a long time ago.
Well, I guess if 90% of the people think that spirit doesn't exist, then that would explain we live in a world that is created by people who fundamentally don't believe in spirit. And this is what the world looks like when you
yeah.
have that.
And we're seeing it today. We're seeing people getting hit on the street because they there are no consequences to it, and it's fun. And, you know, it's society, in my opinion, at this point in time is going downhill. And I just wish that they'd stop and think and feel, because, you know, what we're seeing is the result of society breaking down in all parts of the world. And it's a very sad thing. Now, in my philosophy, humanity has gone through these kind of cycles where we've gone from highly spiritual and we've degraded and degraded and degraded and degraded into a more physical, materialistic time frame. And that at some point in the future, probably, there will be something that takes us back to almost the Stone Age, and the human species will evolve again and grow and get more and more refined and more in touch with nature and build a better society. And then there will be power struggles, and we'll do the same thing over and over and over again. I think we've done it. We've cycled through that kind of a series many times, and I think that we're bottoming out, to use your term, and that eventually
one of the meanings of it, yeah, one of the meanings of bottoming out,
yeah. And if that, but you know, there's always room for wisdom keepers. There's always room for those that have the ability to touch into spirit and bring wisdom. And I will again say that this is my form, my philosophy and my belief, and but to me
it's
religion,
almost like the forbidden archaeology where
yeah.
they find remnants of a supposed lost civilization, and no ordinary theory of evolution or ordinary archaeology would ever argue that there was an entire civilization on Earth that disappeared. But if it was millions of years ago, it could have all been completely lost. As I say it now, it seems impossible, but I know that the argument is made, and
mm-hmm.
it's it conflicts with the evolutionary record, and I don't remember how forbidden archaeology deals with the problem of two timelines. I'd almost need the whole Inner Traditions Library to begin researching some of this. And isn't there also, I can't think of the name of it, the like lost countries.
Oh, sure. Atlantis and Pangea, and sure. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I think what gets me so much at this point in time is that you have all the materialism, but at the same time, the spiritual is still there, and it's not, nobody's burnt at the stake anymore or anything like that, so that the spiritual philosophies are still there, and they can be, anybody, you can be an atheist and still be spiritual. And you know, with organized religions today, you know, you're taught religion, but you are spiritual. The two can coexist beautifully, or they can exist independently. But the reality here is it's all there. It's there for people to reach for and to incorporate into their own philosophy, into their own, if they open their consciousness up. I mean, you know, yes, there are interdimensional portals that people can go through. There's whole bunches of wonderful stuff on the planet. There are power centers where, I mean, crop circles, for heaven's sakes, they're phenomenal. There's so much is standing there in front of us, and people are looking at things and say, like Stonehenge, yeah, that's impressive. And then they go out for fast food, and you know, it doesn't touch them that how did it happen?
Well, we see it in a somewhat different way. You know, it's like now I'm more interviewing you than you interviewing me. But I think more that people are seduced by what looks like pleasure or like what they want, and only when they get it does it seem in some way empty, and usually that causes them to up the ante.
Mm-hmm.
and to then assume that it's because they didn't get enough. And that's, I think, what I see reflected across the civilization, is as the spiritual emptiness becomes greater, the hunger for physical things, material things, increases, and obsession with accomplishments, and even wars are considered accomplishments on the physical plane. They take over, and the emptiness doesn't occur to people because they fill it with more of the same. And there may be flashes, but the flashes of enlightenment or flashes of pleasure and fulfillment, but they don't stay or deepen into what they are. And this is, I'm not speaking as somebody who's figured out how to do this. It's still for me a huge struggle. And the only difference I see, the only thing that alienates me from a lot of the culture, is that I see people kind of falling for what's being marketed. In fact, I have a thing that I have to leave the computer, or I get sucked deeper and deeper into it, because it's almost like it's set up as a vortex to pull you in further and further and further. And there's just so much information, so much energy being thrown about. And it's not focused at all. So the question becomes, I still come back to the older question, which is, how do you translate the fact that you are a spiritual being in a physical realm? How do you translate that into a form of spirituality that you can sustain without becoming manic, without becoming sort of without having to concretize it in some sort of way that you can hold on to it or possess it. How do you dance with it lightly?
Oh, that's easy.
Yeah,
creativity.
I think you're better at it than me.
Creativity. The more you flow into creativity of any kind, whether it's writing, and you don't have to write books, whether it's writing or poetry or gardening or painting or even taking engines apart and putting them back together, even doing jigsaw puzzles is a creative form of creating a whole out of pieces. The more creative you are within your life, the more that energy opens up the portal for spirit to flow through you. That easy. And what you do with that creativity when you've opened that portal, anybody who does anything that is monotonous. I used to do needlepoint and petty point until my eyes decided to, say, we've had it, we're going on strike. But I found that once I got into the repetition of doing it, I would have the most beautiful thoughts and poetry would flow through me and all sorts of cool stuff. And then, I find that today, in one form or another, I find something creative to do. And it doesn't have to be of a spiritual, religious, whatever. It could be reorganizing my cupboard. It could be seeing a different pattern of putting things together. It can be cleaning my garage. I mean, creativity is so expansive. And when you stop to think about the word, if you are creating, you are becoming a creator and getting you more in touch with the source of all creation.
Well, that seems, do you think that's a good point to end on for now, since we're going to talk again next week?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
But
it also lets you put a conclusion on it.
And go and be
creative. I can think of all different ideas that came up that I never got to, but that's the course of these things.
Absolutely. And we will be talking again on Sunday on
Dream Times.
Yes. And we'll be talking about that on Sunday. And, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for hanging in there with me. I am so glad we finally got to do this. And I have tons of questions, too. So we may have to do this again.
Okay.
Thank you so much for being so patient and hanging in there with me.
Okay. Well, until the next time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And I look forward to talking with this wonderful, creative gentleman again. And hang with me because I will be back again. And do check out his website and my website and his books, which are phenomenal. We will talk to you soon. Good day, everybody.